Hello and welcome to New Books in Sports. I'm your host, Bruce Berglund. For each episode of the podcast, we choose an interesting new book on some area of world sport, and we talk with the author. This week, my guest is Matthew Algio. We are discussing his book, Pedestrianism, When Watching People Walk Was America's Favorite Spectator Sport, published by Chicago Review Press in 2014. Matthew is an independent researcher and writer who's written three previous books on curious yet revealing moments in American history. His eye for the obscure and the overlooked brought him to the sport of pedestrianism, which was hugely popular in the United States and England from the mid-19th century to the 1890s. Matthew's book is engaging and at times surprising. He does well both in drawing parallels between pedestrianism and contemporary sports and in connecting this 19th century sport to other longer-lasting innovations of the industrial age. It was a pleasure to speak with Matthew about his book. I hope you enjoy our interview. My guest this week on New Books in Sports is Matthew Algio. Matthew, welcome to the podcast.
Great to be with you, Bruce.
And so we start always with a bit of introduction about our guests. And Matthew, you've written a few books on interesting topics, and you also have something of a globe-trotting life. So why don't you give us a bit of a background about yourself?
Yeah, the exotic life of the non-best-selling author. My background's in radio. I worked in public radio for many years. I got out of college in '88. With a degree in folklore, and not a lot of folklore jobs back then. Not like today. There's tons of folklore jobs. So in '88, I moved to Seattle, and I started working part-time at the public radio station there. And I bounced around and worked for a bunch of public radio stations. In '97, I was working at a station in St. Louis Public Radio. And it was there that I met my wife. We actually met in a Mormon temple. Neither of us are Mormon, but the Mormons open the temple before it's consecrated for a media day. And so my wife was a reporter at a newspaper, and I worked at the radio station. So we're two of the few Gentiles, I guess, who have met in a Mormon temple. And we got married in '98, moved to Maine. I worked about 5 years at Maine Public Radio. And then in 2003, moved to Los Angeles, worked at a public radio program called Marketplace. And that was about the time that Allison, my wife, took the Foreign Service exam, and she passed it. And it was in early 95 that she began her training in the Foreign Service. And we shipped out to our first post, which is in was in West Africa, Mali. And it was while I was there that I began working on my first book. And writing these books, although I joke it's not very lucrative, it does give me something to do. And it's also, most importantly, very transportable. You know, I can do the research while we're back in Washington. You know, Allison comes back here for training between each post. And I can kind of get all the research done at Library of Congress and then go to post and write the book. And my first book was about the 1943 merger of the Pittsburgh Steelers and the Philadelphia Eagles, two NFL teams. And during World War II, the NFL had lost so many players to serve in the armed forces that they were forced to merge the Steelers and the Eagles. And in 1943, for a season, they became the Steagles. And the book is called Last Team Standing, and it's all about the Steagles. And, you know, it's the quarterback is deaf in one ear, the wide receiver's blind in one eye, and, you know, a lot of perforated eardrums, that sort of thing. But it was while I was working on that book that I learned about this sport of pedestrianism. Pedestrianism, it was the most popular spectator sport in the 1870s and 1880s. And I kind of filed that away in the back of my mind. You know, I wanted to I didn't delve into it too much in the Steagles book, but it was always in the back of my mind. And over the years, I've written a couple other books. I wrote a book about Harry Truman and a road trip he took in 1953 and a secret operation on Grover Cleveland in 1893. And but this idea of pedestrianism, watching people walk as a spectator sport, really never left the back of my mind. And so when I had a chance to write about it a couple years ago, I was really glad to jump at it.
And this is something that has been there. You talk about this in your acknowledgments. There have been other authors who've written about pedestrianism. So this is something that historians and writers have taken note of.
Yeah, but it always seems to be sort of in a way, kind of in a passing way. There is a guy, Paul Marshall, who has one of his great great uncle was a pedestrian in the 1890s, and he lives in England, and he's done a ton of research, and he was really helpful to me. I went to England to do some research and met up with him, and he's written basically an encyclopedia of pedestrianism called King of the Peds. Mine's more of a narrative. I kind of focus on just a couple of the pedestrians and use them to tell the story of what the sport was like and what America was like in the 1870s and the 1880s. There's also been a couple. Peter Lovesey, I believe is his name, writes detective novels, and he has set at least one at a great six-day walking match. So it's one of those weird little Victorian things that pops up from time to time. But I don't think anybody had really done, what I'm trying to do with this book is, kind of turn it into, narrative nonfiction and really focus on the characters. And there really were some interesting characters in the sport.
Mm-hmm. Well, before we turn to the book, I want to ask about this degree in your training in folklore, and how that shapes the way that you approach a research topic like pedestrianism and write about it.
Actually, I joke about it a lot, but folklore, and really it's, we're talking about cultural anthropology, mm-hmm. Oral traditions, that sort of thing. And the training for that was absolutely excellent training for journalism and for writing. Studying folklore, you have to learn how to research. And not only that, research topics that might not be very well known. Holiday traditions in the Slavic community of Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, for instance. So you would go find people who would remember what life was like 40, 50, 60 years ago, record them. You have to ask the right questions. You have to be very focused. And also you have to be able to write halfway decently. And so it really did turn out to be an excellent help to me in my future endeavors. It really did.
And I suppose you also have, you develop an eye for the curious.
I guess I've always had that. And that was one of the things that drew me to folklore in the first place. And then later when I got the opportunity to write these books, and I'm really blessed, my wife has a good, stable job and makes a good living that can allow me to indulge in these books. But I've always been drawn to kind of the obscure or the forgotten, the things that kind of fall by the wayside as time passes. And I really like to use those little things like the Steagles or pedestrianism. And then, it's interesting. It's fun for me to go learn more about the times and then use that story to talk about, the era in which they took place.
All right. Well, let's turn to the book, Matthew. And you start the book in 1860 in the United States. The first line is that it begins with a wager. So can you talk about the wager and this first walk and how pedestrianism gains popularity in the United States?
Yeah, it was in the autumn of 1860, a door-to-door bookseller in New England, a guy named Edward Payson Weston, made a bet with a friend of his, and it was really kind of a facetious bet. He bet that Lincoln would lose the presidential election that year. And of course, Lincoln won the election and Weston lost the bet. Now, the terms of the bet were that the loser of the election had to walk from Boston to Washington in 10 days. Nobody really expected anybody to live up to their end of the bet. But Weston, because he was a door-to-door book salesman, he actually walked quite a lot, and he ended up undertaking the walk from Boston. He began on President's Day and arrived on Inauguration Day in Washington. Unfortunately, he was about 4 hours late to witness the inauguration. But nonetheless, the walk itself generated tons of publicity. And newspapers up and down the East Coast especially reported on the progress of Weston's walk. And it turned into kind of a national sensation. And Weston became a very a famous figure. It was a very divisive time in American history. I mean, in the winter of 1860-61, the states are beginning to secede from the Union. There's really not a lot of good news stories in the paper. And so Weston's story, walking from Boston to Washington, crossing the Mason-Dixon line, really generated a lot of interest, and so he became quite famous. And after the war, he decided to capitalize on his popularity and kind of turned pro, began staging walking exhibitions inside roller rinks and other small arenas, and he was really sort of the grandfather of the sport.
And there were other people at the time who were kind of taking up these, let's say, these challenges or dares to have these long distance walks at the time, right?
Yeah, actually, the history of it goes back even further. I mean, in 1809 in England, there was a Scottish aristocrat named Captain Barclay, and he made a bet that he could walk 1 mile every hour for 1,000 consecutive hours. And this drew huge crowds to watch him basically walk a half mile up the street and a half mile back every hour. And he was one of the first first people to popularize the idea of long distance walking. And often wagers were involved in these things. You know, guys would make a bet that they could walk 1,000 half hours every half hour for 1,000 consecutive, you know, half hours, that sort of thing. It really kind of went to a ridiculous extreme. There was one guy who did 1,000, walked a quarter mile every 15 minutes for 1,000 consecutive 15-minute periods. I forget what it is, 11. I mean, it's really just an exercise in sleep deprivation at that point. But yeah, there were a bunch of people who did these long-distance events. But Weston really had the smarts to, A, take it inside where people had to pay to watch you, and B, understand that it was really an event. I mean, he would hire brass bands. He himself would sometimes play the cornet while he walked. And so he really had a sense of combining entertainment and sport in a way that he would really appreciate if he saw some sports today.
Yeah, so he was really a showman.
Yeah, he always wore a long velvet coat and carried a cane and always played up to the crowd. He loved the attention. Now, this was not the case with all the pedestrians, and it really miffed some of his competitors. Weston kind of came from a more of an upper-class background, and as the sport evolved, most of the competitors came from more blue-collar backgrounds, working-class backgrounds, and they just sort of went about it with a grim determination, keeping their face straight down on the track and, you know, churning their arms like pistons. And while Weston sort of, you know, gallivanted about with the coronet and, you know, tossing his cane into the air and catching it, that sort of thing. But Weston had a flair for entertainment, no doubt about it.
Well, let's bring Weston's rival, Dan O'Leary, into the conversation. So can you tell us about him?
Yeah, Dan O'Leary was an immigrant from Ireland to Chicago, and he had heard about Weston's exploits. This is about 1875, 1876, and he actually challenged Weston to a six-day match, and Weston said, well, go set a good record, man. And so O'Leary did. He walked over 100 miles in 24 hours, which was considered sort of the gold standard of pedestrianism at the time, you know, to join the 100-mile club. And then he set a six-day record. I forget, he walked something like 500 miles over 6 days. And so eventually Weston was forced to compete with Leary, against O'Leary, and they had a six-day race in Chicago in 1876, and it was the event of the season. It was held in a huge old building in Chicago. You have to remember at the time, we're really seeing the first big modern public facilities, convention centers, I guess we would call them today. Usually they were considered, you know, agricultural halls. They would have expositions in them, that sort of thing. And Chicago had just built one after the Great Fire, and it could hold 30,000 people or so. And so it was filled every night to watch Weston and O'Leary do this six-day walk. Weston lost, and he complained bitterly that O'Leary had a home field advantage because it had taken place in Chicago, which was O'Leary's adopted hometown, although Weston really only had himself to blame because Weston wanted to hold the event in the largest venue possible to make the most amount of money possible. And so he went to Chicago where the biggest building was and ended up losing.
So, and this is something I really enjoyed about the book, as you describe. You have something of capsule histories of these different venues where they where these races, I guess you would call them, take place. So, in Chicago, you talk about venues in New York as well as London. And so, I'll ask you to talk about the purposes of these buildings because, you know, unlike, you know, today we have indoor track meets and so forth that take place in an arena. But back then, you didn't have indoor sports. So you would take something, as you described it, like a convention center and turn it into an athletic arena.
Yeah, what happened is populations began moving into the urban centers in the United States. There began to be a need for large public buildings. Now, these were really usually constructed just to maybe hold political rallies. There would be religious rallies. Often there was an agricultural component to it. There might be cattle sales. There might be farm machinery conventions where farmers could come and see the latest technology and farm machinery. And they're very simple structures. And usually they just have a big, huge, flat, open floor. And maybe some stands would be constructed around the outside. But most of the time it was just people come stand around the edges of the track. They would build a dirt track in these arenas for the six-day matches, and people would just come and stand and watch. And so it really was the first huge public buildings that the United States had were in the decade after the Civil War. Urbanization, as I said, was the main cause of this. You have people concentrated in the cities. The cities are rapidly expanding, and you need a place for people to convene, whether it's for a political convention or, as I said, maybe it'll be a religious revival, that sort of thing. And so the Expo in Chicago and in New York, you had P.T. Barnum's, what did he call it, the Grand Roman Hippodrome. Mm-hmm. This evolved into the first Madison Square Garden. So these were the first big arenas. At the same time, on the other side of the Atlantic in London, they had the Agricultural Hall, the Aggie, which actually still stands today. It's a convention, basically. It's a convention center. But originally, the Aggie was built as a place for a relatively sanitary place for farmers to bring their livestock and auction it off. And they wanted to move it indoors, and you could control better the animals and sanitation and that sort of thing. So really the big public stadiums that we see today have their roots in these agricultural exposition halls of the mid to late 19th century.
And so how many people would come to these events, these pedestrian races?
It's hard to tell. Madison Square Garden, for example, had a capacity of about 10,000. The six-day races, which began, of course, you couldn't race on Sunday, so they began right after midnight Sunday night and went up straight up until midnight the following Saturday night, and whoever walked the farthest was the winner. The rules are pretty simple. Those races, generally in the evenings, would be a sellout, 10,000 people. But they were continuous events, and so people could come and go.
If you bought a ticket,
right,
you could say, come on Monday and then come back again on Thursday?
No. You could buy what they would call a season pass, where you could come and go. But if you bought a ticket and arrived on Sunday and stayed in the arena until the following Saturday, you could live inside the arena for 6 days. And so this became a problem because a lot of poor people, a lot of transient people would just buy a ticket for 10 cents or a quarter. And if they had a dollar, they could get a sandwich and a coffee every day and basically live inside the arena. Later on, they would do sweeps, and at 3 a.m., everybody would have to leave the arena. And so they got rid of the stragglers. But because if people could come and go as they wanted, the attendances for some of these things, I mean, the capacity of Madison Square Garden's 10,000, six-day race, you would think 60,000 would be the maximum, but actually they get over 100,000, 120,000 people would pay because you could come and go at any time. It was a great spectator sport for people who worked in the new factories, who worked a shift. If your shift ended at 7 a.m. or 3 p.m. or 11 p.m., it didn't matter. Before or after the shift, you could stop by and watch a little of the great walking match. And so it had that advantage of being continuous action, and therefore the promoters were able to continuously sell tickets.
Now, we should probably put continuous action in quotation marks. So, even though we don't have video of these 19th century pedestrian races, I imagine that there was more activity going on within these large halls than just watching people walk around a track. Correct?
I will admit it. What was one of the newspaper quotes? It's not the most entrancing sport. But we go back to Weston here, who they took his idea. And so if you went, especially like for Friday or Saturday night near the end of the race, there would be brass bands. They might have two bands playing, taking turns. The arena would be absolutely pulsing, sold out, people screaming themselves hoarse, wagering going on everywhere, beer just sold by the gallons. The drinking age in New York at the time was 16, by the way. And so it was really like a venue for entertainment more than just watching people walk. You went to hear the music. You went to be part of something. You went to be part of something that was, you know, a big event at the time. And it was like, you know, it was the first time, really, that in America, large numbers of people had gotten together to watch a sporting event. And so it was really historic at the time, in a way. And people really were eager to be part of it. It was a spectacle. They wore colorful costumes. Each of the runners would have his own special running suit. There'd be music. There'd be vendors selling, you know, souvenir photographs of the pedestrians or clam chowder. I mean, it was really, I think if you went back and saw it really at its height when it was really exciting. Now, if you went at 3 a.m. on a Tuesday, most of the competitors might not even be on the track. They might be in bed. They had little cots set up in tents inside the track. And so it really kind of depended when you went. But when it was rocking, I think it was really rocking.
Yeah. And so I was going to ask that as well. When you would talk about these 6-day races, they weren't walking constantly for 6 days. They would come off the track and rest, correct?
They would be on the track out of 24 hours, generally 21 to 22 hours. Most of the pedestrians would take short breaks throughout the day. They wouldn't sleep, for more than 20 or 30 minutes at a time. So generally, there was always somebody on the track. But right, it wasn't. You couldn't really go 24 straight hours walking. Some people that did, but to do it for 6 days, it was almost impossible. And so the best pedestrians really sort of organized their time down to the minute about when they would be on the track, when they would eat, and when they would rest. Weston was like that. He was very neurotic about exactly down to the minute when he would be on the track and when he would sleep and when he would eat. And so the competitors would not be 24 hours, but would still be in motion, usually 21 to 22. I talk in the book a little bit that I think most of these guys were actually polyphasic sleepers, which is this is something where people who do these solo around the world boat races can do this, where you sleep in small increments several times instead of just sleeping once or twice. Most of us, I guess, are monophasic sleepers. We go to bed at 8 p.m. and get up at 5, whatever. But these guys, I think, especially the best, just their bodies were able to get all the sleep they needed in very small increments. And that was a powerful advantage in a sport where, you know, endurance was key.
Yeah. And I want to ask about this. So what was the pace that they set? You mentioned Weston was neurotic about how he planned out his walks. What was the pace that they took as opposed to, say, the pace that you or I would take with, in walking a mile?
Weston actually didn't walk very fast. Weston walked, and the average person walks about 4 miles an hour. Weston walked about 5 miles an hour. He could get up to 6 miles an hour, but generally he didn't walk very fast. The endurance was really the key here, not speed. Now, looking back at some of the descriptions of some of the way people walked at the time, you hear a lot of descriptions about people swinging their hips. I mean, at the beginning, it was strictly walking. You had to keep one foot on the ground at all times. And it really sounds like some of these guys did adopt what we consider the modern speed walking kind, where you really swing your hips. And so those guys could walk really pretty fast. You're getting up into 7, even 8 miles an hour. I mean, basically it's a slow jog. The early pedestrians really did not concentrate on speed. They concentrated more on endurance. And so Weston, although he was very famous as a walker, he wasn't a particularly fast walker. His gift was endurance. Mm-hmm.
You do mention, though, that there were, in some of the later races, there were people who were jogging for part of the race.
Yeah, what happened was as the sport became popular in the 1870s in the U.S., Weston went to England to go on a promotional tour and immediately challenged what was considered the best pedestrian in England to a 24-hour race, and Weston won. And this really hurt the English pride. And so there was a member of parliament, a guy named Sir John Astley, and he proposed a race, a series of races, 6 days long, to determine the world's champion pedestrian. And what they did is that the British considered themselves better runners. than Walker's. And since Astley was British, he got to make the rules. It was a go-as-you-please affair, these Astley Belt races. You could run, walk, crawl, whatever you wanted to do. And so this was sort of moved pedestrianism out of strictly walking into allowing people to run. Ironically, though, for the first couple races, the Americans won. O'Leary won the very first race, which took place in London, and he walked the entire time. It took a while for the people who ran to figure out you can't just run as hard as you, you know, all out for 6 days. It was impossible. And so in these early races, the Americans who were the walkers would be down, you know, would be 100 miles behind after 2 days. And by the fourth day, all the other guys would be taken out of the arena on stretchers. I mean, they couldn't sustain the pace. Slow and steady was the only way to win a six-day race, whether you were walking or running. And eventually, the runners figured out what the walkers already knew, and that was you really had to pace yourself and come up with a schedule. So running was allowed in the later races, and these proved quite popular for a short period of time as well.
So getting back to O'Leary and Weston and their rivalry, this is a rivalry that was carried over to England. They did compete against each other in London,
yeah.
And this drew a lot of attention, having these American walkers come over.
Yeah, that was kind of what spurred Astley to develop his series of races for the Astley Belt. O'Leary and Weston held a big race in London, and it was a huge sensation. It was held at the Aggie, the Agricultural Hall, and thousands of people attended. People were just amazed at how popular it was. Partly the reason it was popular is because they were stand-ins for what was basically an international rivalry. Of course, O'Leary was an Irish immigrant. He was now a citizen, but he was kind of the stand-in for Ireland. And Weston, who was sort of a blue blood from Rhode Island, from New England, he was a real Anglophile. So he sort of represented the British, and so the races kind of were a metaphor for British-Irish relations at the time. And a lot of Irish immigrants went to the Aggie to watch O'Leary, and O'Leary defeated Weston.
And it was a mixed. You also mentioned that Weston had this connection with the upper class. So it wasn't only mixed in terms of having English and Irish. It was mixed in terms of having kind of working class and upper class spectators.
Absolutely. And Weston identified very clearly with the British upper class. I mean, he kind of wanted to have been born into British aristocracy. Unfortunately, he was born in Providence and was not very good with money, so he had neither. O'Leary, of course, Irish immigrant, a working class guy. He was a bookseller as well, coincidentally, just like Weston was. But O'Leary was definitely a working class guy, and he appealed to that element, especially the Irish, as I said. And so it was O'Leary was the working class guy. Weston's the upper class guy. Weston's sort of the stand-in for England. O'Leary the stand-in for Ireland. And so you had all these things playing out at the same time. And again, the first time you've got these big public sporting events in the UK. And so these events are kind of stand-ins almost in a way for larger issues that are playing out in the society at the time.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned that Weston wasn't very good with money. How much, what were the size of the purses for these events? How much were these walkers getting paid?
Yeah, in 1878, 1879, there were a couple of big races in New York City, and Charles Rowell, who was an Englishman, won a couple of them. And for each of those races, he won $20,000, which would be roughly, it's always hard to do this, about $500,000 today. So he won two of these races. So he made basically $1 million that year in 12 days. And so the purses got quite huge. And the problem with it is money ruined the sport in a way, as it always seems to do. As it became more profitable, gamblers got more involved. And you could wager on anything back then. Who would be the first guy to drop out of the race? Who would be the second guy to drop out? Who would finish eighth? Who's going to be in first place after the first day? You could wager on anything. And so gamblers began colluding with some of the less scrupulous pedestrians to fix races. And this really helped put an end to the popularity of the six-day races.
So you've talked about how this was a mass spectator sport and that we have tens of thousands of people buying tickets and coming to these events. This was also something that was widely covered in newspapers. You talk about how Reports of races would go out by telegraph, and there'd be people waiting at telegraph offices to hear the news. It was commercialized in terms of fan memorabilia. And this is something you do very well in the book, that you talk about. This was a modern sport, and a lot of the things that we see in contemporary sports were part of pedestrianism. So can you talk about pedestrianism really as an early example of modern commercialized sport?
Well, one of my favorite examples is that many of the early pedestrians were sponsored, and were sponsored by newspapers. And so they would compete wearing shirts with the newspaper's logo emblazoned across the front. And so it was really one of the first instances of corporate sponsorship. Dan O'Leary, who we've talked about a lot, he became a spokesperson for a brand of salt. These guys were the first celebrity athletes, really. They were, you know, they got corporate endorsements. There was a, you know, when the first trading cards came out and tobacco packs, they featured pedestrians. It really was the first sport that figured out how to monetize the event, and not in just charging attendance. In selling beer and souvenirs, as you said, there was memorabilia. There was a cruise that the pedestrians offered. I found out about where, you know, 10 famous pedestrians, you could cruise with them from New York to Greenwich, and they charge $1 a person to come and just hang out with these guys. And so it's really interesting to see, the very first, like sort of the embryo of the, I call it the sports industrial complex that we have today. But it's really there.
So then the big question would be, why was this so hugely popular?
My short answer is that there wasn't much else to do. I mean, in a way, it was just a matter of timing for this. Snail races might have been just as popular. Somebody had figured out a way to charge people to watch it. I mean, we talked about earlier the construction of these big arenas in public spaces for the first time. Well, all these people are moving into the city, urbanization, industrialization. You have people working shifts now. We're moving from an agrarian to an industrial urban culture. And so for the first time, people have a little bit of extra money in their hands, and then they also have a little bit of extra time. And so this took advantage of both those things. People needed something to do for entertainment. There was very little entertainment, especially for the working class. I mean, a ticket to a play or a musical at the time was about $1, and that was a pretty good wage for a day. And so these events really, really capitalized, really focused on, 10 cents, 25 cents a day to attend one of these matches. That was something that a working person could do. And so it really, really filled a void. It filled a void. And for a short time, its popularity was unparalleled.
And something that you do discuss in the book is that pedestrianism has its popularity just before baseball in the United States and soccer in England emerge as mass spectator sports.
Yeah, baseball was really in its infancy in the 1870s, 1880s. The National League was formed in 1876, but it was really a pretty ragtag enterprise and didn't have a very good reputation either. In the same way in soccer, while pedestrianism was popular, a law was passed that gave working people a half day off, Saturday half day off in the UK, and that allowed soccer to emerge as a popular spectator and participant sport. But these are still sort of working around the edges, and we're talking 1875 to 1885. By 1890, the National League was pretty stable. I forget the exact – I think there were 9 teams. 8 of them are still around. Only the Cleveland Spiders are gone. So it really had become a – baseball by 1890 sort of stabilizes. The owners impose the reserve clause, a salary cap. They control costs. They – free agency is eliminated. And so they did these things, which not probably, the fairest things to do, but it really helped stabilize the sport. And so baseball takes off in the 1890s, really. And the other thing that really killed pedestrianism was the invention of the safety bicycle in the 1880s. Before that, they had the bicycles with the huge front wheel and that little tiny back wheel, the penny farthing, they called them. Well, in the 1880s, the safety bicycle, which is the bicycle we know today, with the two same size wheels, the chain drive shaft, all that became became very popular, and almost overnight, the pedestrians were replaced by bicycle races, six-day bicycle races. It was a lot more exciting to watch a six-day bicycle race than a six-day walking match. You know, I say pedestrianism was like NASCAR at 4 miles an hour. Well, now it was like NASCAR at 15 miles an hour, but they actually had crashes, and it was much more spectacular sport, and it proved immensely popular. I mean, the six-day bicycle races were really, until the early 20th century, quite popular in the U.S.
So, Matthew, your book focuses on O'Leary and Weston, but there's one other competitor that you do talk quite a bit about, and that's a walker named Frank Hart. And so yeah. Can you explain, talk about him and his significance?
Black guy. He was he came from Haiti. He was born in Haiti, but came to Boston and was working as a grocery store clerk. And on a lark, entered I think it was a 24-hour race and finished in second. And he got noticed by Dan O'Leary. O'Leary, as he was getting older, was looking to move into promotion and instead of competing. And he saw this pedestrian, Dan Hart, and kind of took him under his wing. Dan O'Leary was Frank Hart's mentor. O'Leary was his, and Hart was his protege. And O'Leary trained Frank Hart, and Frank Hart ended up winning a couple of big races, a major race in New York in the early 1880s. And he really was the most famous black athlete in the United States at the time. I mean, he was really the first famous black athlete, you could make the argument, in the United States at the time. And it's really interesting to see that the sport at the time was really, it was open. In one of the races, Hart won. Another African-American, another black competitor finished second. So pedestrianism really, I mean, if you could walk and if you could live without sleep for 6 days, if you had endurance, pedestrianism really opened doors. O'Leary, the Irish immigrant, Frank Hart, the Haitian immigrant. There were women walkers too, who competed in their own 6 day races. And so you had this whole variety, of competitors in a way that you really wouldn't expect for the time.
Mm-hmm. And Hart was something that was interesting in your book. Hart was quite popular with spectators.
He was, Frank Hart was extremely popular with black and white spectators. He really, he did something that endeared him to all spectators. Charles Rowell was a famous English pedestrian, and he had this really annoying tactic where he would run up close behind a competitor and sort of dog him, just stay right behind him step for step. Well, Frank Hart did this to Rowell. He turned the tables on him in a race in New York, and the spectators just loved this, and they chanted Hart's name, Hart, 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 and it really win him a lot of fans. People enjoyed his tenacity, and I think people appreciated his status as an underdog, not only in the sport but in the culture as a whole. It was really interesting how the sport, in a way, for black athletes in the United States, it was almost more opportunity in the decades between the Civil War and the early 20th century. Moses Fleetwood Walker was the first African-American baseball player. He played in one of the major leagues at the time. I mean, it really wasn't until you get the Plessy versus Ferguson, you get formalized segregation, that black athletes are not allowed to compete with or against white athletes. And so it was that really where really a short window there in the 1870s or 1880s where blacks and whites competed together.
So when did we've talked about some of the reasons why pedestrianism lost popularity. When did pedestrianism, what would be the word, when did it disappear from the sporting scene?
Well, it died a pretty quick death, as I mentioned, when bicycle racing became popular in the mid-1880s. Really, by 1890, the great six-day matches were a thing of the past. They had been replaced by bicycle races. They built banked tracks for the bicycles to race on so they could go even faster. But even bicycle racing faced some obstacles. And in New York, by the 1890s, these six-day races, be it pedestrian, walking, running, bicycling, were kind of seen as cruel. I mean, people, one of the reasons you went to watch these races was to see the crash. I mean, it's like people who go to NASCAR races. Part of the spectacle is the accident, and people would go to watch a 6-day bicycle race or a 6-day walking match just to see people in the last throes of sanity, barely staggering around the track, trying to keep their balance. I mean, this was amusing for some people, and it disturbed a lot of people. There were sermons against 6-day races, and eventually there was legislation in New York State. There was a bill introduced in 1899 to ban 6-day exhibitions of any kind. And so the bill was passed by the legislature, and it was signed by the governor, who at the time was Theodore Roosevelt, who, of course, was one of our most active. He never shied away from strenuous activity, but he agreed that the 6-day races had become less athletic competitions and more exercises in, of cruelty, of taking advantage of the competitors for the enjoyment of the spectators. It had become gladiatorial, one of the sermons said.
So your last chapter of your book brings to a close the stories of Weston and O'Leary. And something that was striking is that they remained, I don't know if we would say famous, but kind of popular figures well into the 20th century or early 20th century.
Weston continued to stage long distance walking exhibitions into his 80s. He walked from New York to San Francisco. He did a walk from Buffalo to New York. He did long walking exhibitions, and what he would do is he would get sponsors and he would sell a program as he walked along. And so you'd buy a 5 cents, buy a souvenir program for 5 cents, and then he would sell ads inside the program, and that's how he kind of funded himself. Ironically, I believe it was in the mid-1920s, 1927, I guess he was 80, 85, 87, he was hit by a car crossing the street in New York and was never able to walk again and died a couple years later at the age of 90. O'Leary, in the meantime, he became a baseball pedestrian. He would go to baseball games and challenge the fastest runner on the team to run around the bases twice while he walked around them once. And then he would walk through the stands, hat in hand, literally collecting nickels and dimes. And that's how he funded his retirement, by staging these exhibitions. And so they both remain loyal to the sport right to the bitter end. And Weston and O'Leary were still famous names when they passed away in the 1920s. But of course, by now they're all but forgotten.
So, Matthew, I have to ask: in the course of your research, did you attempt any walking feats to just see what this was like?
I really, actually, the book began like the first proposal I had way back when I was doing the research for the Stiegels book, and I discovered this Captain Barkley who walked one mile every hour. For 1,000 consecutive hours, which I think is 41 days. And what I wanted to do was recreate that walk. Yeah. And then tell the story of Barkley and pedestrianism in there while I do that walk. Well, my wife was not enamored of that idea in the least. And, now that we have a baby girl, it would have been a little hard to just say, honey, I'm going to go walk a mile every hour for the next month and a half. But I really thought that would have been cool. I think it's entirely doable. But I was told I couldn't do it, I guess is the answer to your question. I did see, there was a 6-day race in Alaska, in mid-August, that was held in, Anchorage at a dome, there, which was really one of the first official 6-day races that's been held in the United States for some 15, 20 years. And I would have loved to have gone to attend that. I'm not much of an athlete myself. I suppose maybe I'm living vicariously through the book. So, but I would like to do I like walking. I have a Fitbit, so I can measure how much I walk every day. And I would really like to, if I had the time, to try something like that.
Yeah. I asked because I wanted to get a sense of if you had a personal experience and how draining or difficult this was. Because when you read about, they walked around a track inside of an arena or a convention center, there's kind of, I would say, this sense of, well, how hard can that be? But as you describe in the book, at the end of these races, these 6-day races, they were just on the verge of collapse.
Yeah, it was, and a lot of them suffered very poor health later in life. I mean, Weston and O'Leary were the exceptions when it comes to the, you know, living a long, healthy life. Frank Hard, who we mentioned earlier, the black pedestrian, he died quite young in his 50s, I believe, and it's believed he may have contracted. One of the things, these guys, these races were lucrative, but they would do it all the time. You know, you would do a 6-day race in Chicago, and then you might go down to St. Louis, you know, 2 weeks later, do a 6-day race there, and then to Philadelphia and do a 6-day race. And so the damage they did to their bodies just must have been tremendous. And I think a lot of them died prematurely as a result of that. And the environment, you know, these arenas were terrible, smoke filled, disgusting. Oh, everybody would just be spitting their tobacco on the track. I mean, it was not really the best environment for an athletic event to take place in. And so I'm sure that did even more injury to them.
Yeah, there was one place where you described that, and it hit me that they're walking around in these enclosed buildings filled with smoke from the oil lamps and cigar smoke, cigarette smoke. And I thought, wow, what a terrible environment for any kind of athletic activity.
Weston hated smoking and begged. In fact, one of the races, he insisted it be that they post no smoking signs, and they did, although it wasn't strictly adhered to. But it might have been one of the first instances of a major public event, sporting event being smoke-free. Weston absolutely hated the smoking. It's ironic that he was featured on some of the first tobacco cards because he hated tobacco. But yeah, it was very unsanitary conditions, very unsanitary conditions in some of these arenas.
Well, Matthew, I'll ask what you're working on next. Do you have a new book project?
I do. I have a book coming out next spring, actually, and it is about Abraham Lincoln's dog, Fido. So,
really? Lincoln, that was the name of Lincoln's dog?
Yes, it was. In fact, Lincoln's Fido is sort of the Fido, the original Fido, that popularized the name of dogs in the United States. Fido, Lincoln's Fido, Fido comes from Fidelis, Latin for faithful or loyal. And so Lincoln named the dog Fido because he was so faithful. And Lincoln could not take the dog with him to Washington. His dog was very skittish, and so he broke the news to Willie and Tad. It was Willie and Tad's dog. They took care of it, and so they left the dog with a neighbor. And after Lincoln became president, Fido was the most famous dog in the United States. But he didn't have a lot of competition. There weren't a lot of famous dogs in the United States at the time. So yeah, Fido was really interesting at the time. You know. Fido was kind of a status symbol for Lincoln. To own a dog that was purely a pet with no economic purpose was kind of unusual in the 1850s. We're just beginning to see the beginning of the modern pet industry, I guess you could call it. And so the book is about the history of pets and Lincoln's affection for animals. I mean, his attitude toward animal welfare was way ahead of its time. And so we kind of wrap all that stuff up in the story of Fido.
You've been listening to an interview with Matthew Algio about his book, Pedestrianism, When Watching People Walk Was America's Favorite Spectator Sport, published in 2014 by Chicago Review Press. New Books in Sports is part of the New Books Network, which offers dozens of channels of podcast interviews with the authors of new publications on subjects from history to popular music. If you like what you heard here, please follow New Books in Sports on Twitter at New Books Sports or friend us on Facebook at facebook.com/newbooksinsports. I'm your host, Bruce Berglund. Thanks for listening and enjoy your week. We'll be right back.